It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. David Chazony, whose first book, The Ten Commandments, How Our Most Ancient Moral Texts Can Renew Modern Life, was a finalist for the National Jewish Book Award. His writings have appeared in The New Republic, The Forward, Commentary, Moment, The Jerusalem Post, and other publications. And from 2004 to 2007, he served as editor-in-chief of Azur, which was Israel's leading journal of public affairs. Dr. Chazony received his PhD in Jewish philosophy from the Hebrew University, where he focused his research on the thought of Eliezer Berkowitz, and he's edited two volumes of Berkowitz's writings, and he's actually giving a session on Berkowitz this afternoon. So please welcome David Chazony.
Morning. I think I might step away from the mic. Can you hear me okay if I'm away from the mic?
Not the recording.
There's a recording. Okay, my apologies. Very good. All right. Good thing the coffee is here. Okay, I'm just getting to walk over and move the... So first of all, thank you so much, Elliot. Where'd you go? For Elliot and Jay for organizing this conference, and Elliot for putting me up in his house, and all of you for coming out so early. For me, it's early. So early on a just changed the clock Sunday morning. The Ten Commandments are a nearly universal symbol, right? We see them everywhere. The Ten Commandments, right? It was this movie we saw growing up. The Ten Commandments. It was something we saw very prominently displayed in shul, or in a courthouse if you're of a certain bent. The truth is, you know, with all the debates in the United States about the positioning of the Ten Commandments, excuse me. Hi, good morning. Good to see you. You know, these debates in the United States, in the Supreme Court, over whether or not the Ten Commandments can be positioned in front of courthouses, very rarely is it known that inside the United States Supreme Court chambers, inside the court, on the wall is a picture of Moses with the Ten Commandments. They are a symbol. They're in churches. They're in synagogues. They're everywhere. But if you ask people what they symbolize, what do they mean, you're going to get very different answers. If you ask many Christians, for example, Christian theologians, what do the Ten Commandments mean? What do we need them for? You're going to get two different answers. One answer is going to be sort of the, you know, this. We Christians know that the Ten Commandments are actually for the Jews, right? They are the Mosaic covenant that God had with the Israelites on Mount Sinai. They're not really, I mean, it was replaced later on by a different covenant. And the way you know that is because it has the Shabbat, this thing about the Sabbath in it, which we Christians don't actually observe. Some will tell you it's about the covenant of God with the Israelites. Other Christians will tell you that it's a symbol of faith, that the faith that you have in God is symbolized by these Ten Commandments. Many Orthodox Jews, most Orthodox Jews, if you ask them what the Ten Commandments symbolize, they're going to tell you that they symbolize the foundations of halakha, of keeping Jewish law. There are laws, there are Taryag Mitzvot, 613 laws. We keep the laws of God, And this is symbolized by the Ten Commandments, and they may even, if they are more learned, may go so far as to tell you that the rabbis taught that all of the 613 commandments are contained in the Ten Commandments, and that some rabbis went so far as to actually try to make lists of how the different 613 commandments divide into the ten categories. And if you turn to more secular Israelis or many Reform Jews and ask what the Ten Commandments symbolize, they're going to tell you something completely different. They're going to say the Ten Commandments represent our moral and ethical tradition and our commitment to universal ethics and morality. But the funniest thing about the Ten Commandments, this is where it gets a little weird. The funniest thing about the Ten Commandments is that according to polls in the United States, 90% of Americans have a strong opinion as to whether or not the Ten Commandments should be portrayed in public places. But only 40% of Americans can name more than four of them. Okay? And at this moment, the textually sensitive Jew, his eyes widen and his ears perk up. Because what becomes very apparent is that while it's a symbol, it's a symbol, it's a symbol for everybody, for the great majority of people, it has stopped being a text. It stopped being actual words with actual individual meaning to them. So now I want to understand where I'm coming from with the Ten Commandments and what my approach was to writing this book on the Ten Commandments, which I understand will be available afterwards. I have to tell you a little bit about my personal background. I was raised in the forlorn state of New Jersey. We have more New Jerseyans here. That's good. In an Israeli home. My parents were Hebrew speakers. And I grew up speaking Hebrew. And not quite reading and writing, but a lot of speaking. And I grew up in America in the 70s, where your encounter with the Bible varies tremendously depending on what day you happen to turn the television on. If you turn on a Sunday morning, for example, then the Bible, that is to say the Tanakh, that is to say the foundations of my ancient Hebrew heritage, is being presented by a whole variety of Christian preachers on a Sunday morning, zipping through turning the channels. As you know, they used to turn channels on television. That's what's called a dial. It's because you dialed it. But, you know, so that was one Bible that was supposed to be my Bible. When I went to Sunday school later that same day, at the local Jewish center, which was somewhere between Reform and Conservative. And there the Bible was not really taught, but when it was taught with a lot of a lot more attention to what it wasn't. You know, was not given to Moses by God, and this was not what we really think today, and so forth. And then later in life I went to yeshiva. And in yeshiva, I don't know if you're aware, in yeshiva, by and large, the Bible is much shorter. It's, you know, the Bible is like this fat, but in yeshiva, it's only the first five books, right? And those books are read and read and read and studied. But if you study Gemara, and if you ask somebody, have you ever read a pasuk from Amos? And they'll say, sure, it's in Gittin. Right? There is no Tanakh, very little. And the concept that there might be a whole worldview being presented that's important to know and important to encounter and important to engage with is kind of alien to the yeshiva world. So when I made Aliyah, I was very troubled by all of this. And I knew that I was coming to a country, to Israel, where the Bible was very important. Where in Israeli society and culture, Tanakh was an important feature of society, and that if you really want to understand what it means to be Israeli, what it was that drove Ben-Gurion to hold Bible sessions in his home, what's driving the debates over archaeology and secular education and so much of Israeli culture that sort of resonated around Tanakh, you had to have read Tanakh. So I went and read it, and I studied it from beginning to end, straight through, in Hebrew, with the help of a little translation, of course. And what I discovered was that there really is an entire approach to life, an entire worldview that had somehow escaped me in all my years of engagement with different people filtering the Tanakh in all the different ways for me. Now, the Ten Commandments are presented in the Bible as the single most important text ever given to mankind. That's how it appears in the story. Okay, there is no other text that is called that appears on the tablets of the covenant, Luchot HaBrit. There is no other text that is placed into the Ark of the Covenant and carried forward in battle in front of the children of Israel. There is no other text that is put in the center of the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle in the desert and later in the temple in Jerusalem. This is it. The Ten Commandments are supposed to be the single most important thing. And that's how they're presented in the text, even though later on in Jewish tradition, they were somehow, minimized, downgraded, underplayed a little bit. But in the Torah, looking at the Torah purely on its own merits, that's the impression you get. Ten Commandments are very, very, very important. But what are they? What are they? How are you supposed to read them? What are you supposed to do with them? So, the first clue that I had was that they're not, in Hebrew, they're of course not called the Ten Commandments. Okay, they're not. Ten Commandments in Hebrew, if it had been the Ten Commandments, would have been, well, how do you say commandments in Hebrew? Okay, in Hebrew, the word for commandment in Hebrew is mitzvah. In English, that translates as mitzvah. Okay. And the Ten Commandments would have been Eser HaMitzvot. Right? Mitzvah is feminine. So it would have been Eser, not Aseret. Eser HaMitzvot. But how does it, what does the Torah call the Ten Commandments? I can't hear, louder? Aseret HaDibrot. That is incorrect. Okay, they're not called Aseret HaDibrot. Aseret HaDibrot is what the rabbis call them. They're called Aseret HaDvarim. Okay, in the Torah, it is called Aseret HaDvarim. Now, it sounds almost the same, but it's actually not. Okay, the word Aseret HaDibrot, you've heard it all before because that's what the rabbis call it in the Mishnah and elsewhere. It's always called Aseret HaDibrot. The problem with the word Aseret HaDibrot is that the word Dibrot doesn't appear in any other context. Okay, the singular of Dibrot is Diber. Okay, those of you who think it's Dibra, that's another mistake. It's not Dibra. There's no such word as Dibra. Dibra would be feminine, and there would have been Eser and not Aseret. Aseret is a masculine. The singular of Dibrot is Diber. Aseret HaDibrot are the 10 Diber things. And the problem is that there's no such thing as a Diber. Okay, the best definition I can come up with a diber is one of the things up on the Ten Commandments. Okay, nobody else says there was this diber and it was important. But if you go and look at the word dvarim, aseret hadvarim, that means something. That means something very, very serious. Because the singular of dvarim is davar. And what is a davar? What does the word mean? Thing. What?
A word or a thing.
It's actually three things. It means word. It means thing. And to some degree, it also means an event. Okay? When they say, Nafal Devar B'Israel, it's a way of something. Something big just happened. Okay? So, Aseret HaDvarim are the 10 big things. Okay, the 10 big, you can call them utterances. It's the closest thing we have is utterances. But utterances is this long and, you know, kind of Latin-y word that doesn't, you know, it doesn't sound like dvar, right? So when you say there are 10 dvarim, you're saying these are the 10 biggest things that could possibly have been said. And that's the text that you have before you that I've handed out. Okay, this is, it's my translation. We're not going to read through the whole thing, because I have some other ground to cover in this talk. But as we go through the Ten Commandments, I'm going to do is I'm going to take you through, I'm going to walk you through what I have done with the Ten Commandments, what I've discovered in the Ten Commandments, and what I hoped, what I covered mostly in my book. But and what we'll do is we're going to go through them one by one. Some of them I'm going to spend a little bit more time on, and the others we're going to kind of zip through, because I want to give you an understanding of where, what I came up with. Okay, my best attempt to understand what these 10 big things are. Now, what Dvarim tells me is that the Ten Commandments are to be read paradigmatically. Okay, they are not 10 mitzvot. They might also be 10 mitzvot. They might also have legal status. They might also be technical legal terms or rules that must be followed. But that's not what's important about them within the presentation of the text of the Torah. Okay, we have 10 big things. And I take that to mean that they are to be read paradigmatically. When the rabbis said that that all of the Torah is contained in the Ten Commandments, I don't see that as you're supposed to divide up all the mitzvot in the 10 categories. I see that as here are 10 comprehensive statements which taken together constitute a whole worldview that the Torah is trying to get across. This is how you should live. You want to know how to live? Get behind these 10. Understand them. Figure out what they mean. Live your life according to this worldview. And all the rest will fall into place. All the rest will make sense. So, without further ado, I would like someone to read the first commandment. Loud and with feeling. Go ahead. Just the first one.
I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt from the house of slavery.
Excellent. Thank you. The first commandment. By the way, just so you should know, I have divided up these commandments according to the Jewish tradition. There are other traditions for how the commandments are divided up. The principal biggest differing tradition is the Catholic tradition. The Catholic tradition takes the second commandment about idols and sort of smears it into the first commandment because they don't want to emphasize the idol problem. And then to make up for that, they take the 10th commandment, which is about coveting, and they split that into two commandments so that because they, I think, have perhaps issues about coveting. No, seriously, I think that in Catholicism, the inner workings of the heart, questions of lust, questions of what you're feeling and thinking are actually, not just Catholicism, I think the New Testament focuses on your feelings as having moral danger, moral peril, more so than does the Jewish tradition. And so it makes sense that the 10th commandment becomes two different commandments. I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt from the house of slaves. Anochi Adonai Elohecha asher hoceiticha me'eretz Mitzrayim mibeit avadim. The first thing you need to notice, of course, is the word your. I am the Lord your God. Remember, we're talking about the Ten Commandments. We're talking about the revelation of Mount Sinai. We're talking about the moment at which the Israelites have left Egypt, left slavery, wandered through the desert, gotten to Mount Sinai, spent 3 days enduring some kind of bizarre, crazy, psychedelic, wacky, loud, smoky, multi-sensual experience before getting any of the commandments. Okay, it is terrifying, and it doesn't stop. At a certain point, they say, we can't handle this anymore. They send Moses up into the heart of darkness, up on top of the mountain, to get the commandments for them. But this is the peak of it all. And at this moment, God reveals himself to the Israelites, and he does so in a way that is fitting to what he wants to get across. This is the first commandment. This is not, as some Christian commentators believed, an introduction or a preamble. This is the first of the 10 big statements. So we have to read it really carefully, because we know that if God is introducing himself, he could do it a million different ways, right? We know that he could have said, as he says elsewhere, I am the Lord of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Or he could have said, I am the Lord who created the universe. Now, that's only assuming he stayed within a biblical idiom, but since he was writing this stuff, he could have veered from the biblical idiom and said something like, I am the Lord your God, the omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent God, and if that contradicts itself, that's not my problem. He could have even said, as I'm sure some people today would have liked him to say, I am the cruel Old Testament God who uses words like jealous and who will thankfully be supplanted by a much more benign and abstract God of later centuries. And instead, we get a very, very simple statement. I'm the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt from the house of slaves. Now, let's hold on that Yetziat Mitzrayim part of it for 1 second. I want to focus back on the word your. Because to have a God, for God to be your God, is not the same as him just being God. Right? To have a God, well, what does it mean to have a God? What do you do to a God or for or with? Or what does it mean? What does it mean to have a God? Worship, that's one. What else? Okay, you have an address, a complaint box, or for times of trouble, for help, yeah. You own him or he owns you? He's our God. You have a connection. Okay, yeah. So there's a relationship of mutual obligation. Okay, but that's sort of circular because we're trying to figure out the content of the covenant. We're trying to figure out what that covenant is, what's in it. One of the things that appears in the Torah, perhaps more clear in ancient Israel than in any other ancient cultures. I could be wrong, and I would be happy to be corrected, but my understanding is that in most ancient societies, what you do not have so much in the relationship between people and their gods is the concept of imitation. Okay, we have a concept that God is not just to be worshipped, feared, and his commandments followed. We also have a concept of imitating. That God is in some sense an actor who behaves in a way that is in a sense an idealized form of what we ought to behave like. Okay, you have Kedoshim tiyu ki kadosh anochi, ki kadosh ani. In Vayikra, right? You should be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy. We have Ve'alachta bidrachav, you shall go in his pathways. And the rabbis pick up on this and say, just as he is merciful, so should you be merciful. Just as he is benevolent, so should you be benevolent. We have an engagement with a God who isn't just an arbitrary, crazy, altogether the Christian theologian Rudolf Otto called holy other. Okay, in our tradition, God is not holy other. He is an ideal, or he behaves in a way that should be imitated. And if this is the case, and in a minute we're going to find out how specific and precise this commandment to imitate can really get when we get to the fourth commandment. But if that's the case, if God is to be imitated and not just worshipped, if I'm right, then the first commandment suddenly takes on a wholly different meaning. Because all of a sudden, when God says, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt from the house of slaves. And he says that the most important thing you need to know about me at this crucial moment in history, in which I'm laying forth number one of the top ten, the thing you need to know about me is that I took you out of Egypt. The principle, what I call the principle of redemption, is the idea that just as God, number one thing to know about God is that he intervenes in history to make human life better, that's also the number one way that we have to orient ourselves. Now, it happens that throughout the Tanakh, people are judged according to this principle, according to their ability to enter the world, to intervene in human history, and to make the world better. Kings are judged according to whether or not the world they leave behind them is a better world. Prophets are there purely for the purpose of trying to intervene through their words. In fact, biblical characters in general are redeemers when they are considered good characters. And when they're bad characters, it's because they're doing bad things in the world. It's not because of the impurity of their heart. It's not because of their failure to sufficiently or properly meditate. It's not even so much about their character, although their character is crucial, but it's their character in as much as it impacts upon their world. I'll go even further. I'll say that God, too, throughout the Tanakh, is nothing if not an intervener. It doesn't mean he always intervenes. But as a reader, when we read through the Tanakh, we encounter God only as either one who intervenes through miracles or through prophecy, through words to people, through communication or through action, or one who is so fed up by the behavior of mankind that he refrains from intervening. And that's also what we know about him. But we see basically nothing resembling, you know, and God played with the Leviathan for a week. You know, the things that the rabbis like talk about in Midrashim, these sort of wacky, weird stories. We don't see that in the Tanakh. In the Tanakh, God is not out there doing things on his own, in his own world. Our encounter with God, I'm not saying what he is or what he isn't, I'm just saying how he appears in the Tanakh, is only with relation to the world, and specifically the human world, right? You don't have stories about, and then God decided one day to invent the earthquake in an unpopulated area. Okay, there is no God in the Tanakh who is not in some way relating to mankind. Mostly the children of Israel, but not exclusively. Sometimes you have prophets who are giving speeches to other peoples about their moral status and how they can improve their moral worlds. But this concept of redemption, you know, you only really understand it if you're growing up in a Jewish world, you only really get how unique and how powerful it is when you start going through other cultures' ancient stories. When you start looking at Greek traditions, and you start looking at Indian stories, and you start looking at mythology of other cultures, and you discover how really focused, almost obsessively focused, the Tanakh is on how good people are, and how good their societies are. Of course, the definition of what good is still one we haven't fully addressed. So this is sort of a meta concept, this concept of redemption. I want to carry through. What we're going to do is we're going to zip forward. I will quickly touch upon the second and third commandment and then get a little more deeply into the fourth commandment. The second commandment is about you shall not have idols. It's about idolatry. But it's also, you know, when you try to understand what the problem with idolatry is, of course, we always like to say it's about monotheism, right? Monotheism meaning there is one God. And then you read the Bible and you discover that the number one case of idolatry, the most important case of idolatry in the whole Bible is the golden calf. How many golden calves were there? Just one. So, I mean, later there were a couple more, but in Exodus there's just one. So that suggests that the problem with idolatry is not the number. It's not about this one God, and you crazy peoples have lots of gods. Okay, when you go through the Tanakh and look into the way idolatry is described, you discover that it's described as three things. And again, I promise I'd skip through that quickly, but I have to explain it. It's about the worship of power, human power, or gods that you believe are powerful in this world. It's about the worship of beauty. That golden calf was really, really pretty against the backdrop of the bland desert. And it's about worshiping the works of our own hands, right? If you look through the way the prophets and the Psalms talk about what's wrong with idolatry, you discover that the people who make them really fall in love with them. Okay, in one story, there's I think it's in Yeshayahu, where he says, you know, the idolater, what does he do? He takes a chunk of wood. With half of it, he makes a fire and cooks his dinner and says, aha, I am sated. And with the other half, he makes an idol and bows down to it. Okay? And you know, how moronic is this to ascribe divinity to the things that we ourselves have created? In the end, in the Psalms, it says that Kmohem you osehem. The people who make them will end up being like them. Just like they have eyes but can't see and have ears but can't hear, so too are the people who make them. Okay, so what we learn about the second commandment is it's really about cutting ourselves or learning to limit the impact of those things that distract us from the higher good and from morality, and it becomes the foundation of the concept of morality. Third commandment, you shall not take the Lord's name in vain. It's not about not saying, I mean, I understand we also don't say God's name. And in American popular culture, that has gone very far to strange phrases like gosh darn it and Jiminy Cricket for Christians, and all of which they feel stem somehow from the third commandment. The third commandment is, in fact, about something else entirely. It's about not swearing false oaths. Okay? Lo tisa et shem Adonai lashav, to invoke the name for naught, it means you don't swear a false oath. Okay, in the ancient world, anytime people wanted to say, I really, really, really want you to believe that what I'm saying is true, they would swear on the thing they hold dear. And we would swear by the name of God. So what it's saying is, if you're going to do that, you better be 100% on target. Whether you're promising something or describing something, any oaths you take, you better not be false. You know, even in modern Hebrew, if you say something that sounds outlandish, it is not uncommon that the person you are talking to will suggest that you swear on the life of your own mother. Bema shulcha. Okay, that's what the phrase bema shulcha, or b'chayai. Okay, b'chayai is a compacted version of I swear on my own life. Okay, and you see this in Chazal also, right? Kippa shel Romi, sometimes you hear, right, where someone will swear on the dome in Rome, okay? We swore on things we believed in. And the reason this is important is because if you don't have oaths, then the entire world descends into a world of dishonesty. Okay, the dishonesty is the natural state of things. Dishonesty is what people will do to get what they need, because words by nature are manipulative. Words by nature are teleological. I want to get something. I have a goal. Okay, children learning to talk will learn how to talk first of all to achieve their goals. And only secondly, when a parent enforces honesty and teaches a child to make words match reality, only then do they learn. So if we did not have oaths, if we did not have institutions, we would not have honesty. And the point of the third commandment is to create that place in the world that makes honesty possible. If you have oaths that work, you can also ripple that out into the rest of the world and have a concept of integrity and honesty that is functional. But I want to focus on the fourth commandment. Can somebody read? I need a different volunteer to read the fourth commandment. Someone with much caffeine in their system. Someone with secret thespian leanings. Somebody who really, really, really wanted to get up this morning and read the Fourth Commandment. And if it's none of you, then it will be Francis. Yes, go ahead. Okay, Francis, you're up for number 10.
Remember the Sabbath day to sanctify it. 6 days you shall labor and complete all your work, but the seventh will be a Sabbath for the Lord your God. You shall do no work, neither you nor your son nor your daughter, your manservant or your maidservant, your beast or your stranger in your gate. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens, the earth, and the sea, and all that is in them, and he rested on the seventh day.
This is the only specific mitzvah in the whole Torah where we're told to do something because God did it. Okay? We are told to keep, and you'll recognize that text for those of you who make Kiddush. We're supposed to keep the Sabbath because God did it. God rested on the seventh day. Now that's perfectly fine, except for one problem. If you want to do something because God did it, it helps a lot to know why God did it. Anything, right? If you want to imitate, you can't really imitate unless you have what's behind it. Because you want to imitate, you want to get it right. And the Torah doesn't tell us why God rested on the seventh day. There's no explanation given. Worse than that, it is obviously counterintuitive that God should rest. After all, he does not have a body. He does not need to rest mentally. He doesn't get tired. I mean, he shouldn't get tired. He doesn't need to bulk up with steroids or anything like that. He's just God. And if he's going to rest on the seventh day, and we're supposed to do that, we really, really, really had better figure out why he did it, or else we're not going to have any idea what we're supposed to do on Shabbat. So, I offer the following theory. I hope it's a good one. Which goes like this. If you were given the task of writing the Torah, writing the most important book for mankind, you would probably begin it with foundational principles. Okay? So, for example, when Maimonides wanted to write the book, which in his own testimony was the only book you'll need other than the Torah. That's what he said. He wrote it as a book of halakha, and he started it with a chapter called, I mean, I think you have to think that he's got like this little irony thing going on, because there's a wink there. He calls it Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah, the laws of the foundations of the Torah. And the book, and the first section is just philosophy. Okay, it's not laws. There's no rules of how to behave in Hilchot Yisodei Torah. It's called Hilchot Yisodei Torah because everything is halacha in this book. And so is philosophy. Why not? You know? This is what you should think. This is the halacha of what to think. Okay, but he wrote a book that was the first principles. And the first line in that book is the first, you know, Yisod HaYisodot. The first principle of the foundation of foundations. So it's totally rational and logical and reasonable that somebody who's writing the big book will start with the foundations. And if you want to know why I'm unimpressed by the entire debate between, you know, is it literally, you know, creation 6 days, is it not, why I feel this is not fundamentally a Jewish argument, is because whatever happened, what we do know is that this opening section of the book is really, really important and foundational. It sets up the basic relationship between God, creation, and mankind. And if you ask yourself, what would that have read like? What would the opening chapters of Genesis have read like if there had not been a seventh day? You would come to the conclusion that God is inseparable from his acts of creation. That God is a creator and nothing else. That God creates and creates and creates and creates and creates, and that's it. And by implication, so should we. As soon as you have a seventh day of rest, what you have is the establishment of God as separate from creations. God takes a day to stop doing and to start being. It allows us to worship God and not to worship creation. Because that's what would have happened if there had not been a seventh day. We would say creation is God. We would tumble down into pantheism. Okay, the seventh day is what keeps us from believing that our world is God. Because God exists separately. But it's the only mitzvah that we're supposed to imitate explicitly. The only concrete, specific mitzvah that we imitate. So therefore, the purpose of Shabbat, we have no other conclusion to draw, if I'm correct, that the purpose of Shabbat is for us to be instead of to do. For us to find our place in the universe separate from our own acts of creation. For us to affirm the self. Now, the Shabbat, it's a funny kind of, the laws of Shabbat, for those of you who know, are founded around what are called the 39 categories of melacha, of work. Right? You shall do no labor, there are 39 categories. Those 39 categories of work are, according to the Talmud, the 39 things that were done in the context of building the tabernacle in the desert. Building and operating the tabernacle in the desert, the Mishkan. Which is a little bizarre because, again, you discover very quickly that some of these things are not really tiresome. Some of them are not really expending a lot of energy. Some of them are just, you know, writing down a word, jotting something down, is a violation of one of these categories of labor. My teacher, Joseph Isaac Lifshitz, wrote a really powerful essay about Shabbat in which he pointed out that to understand what this is all about is to understand that what you're supposed to stop doing on Shabbat is you're supposed to stop doing creative activity. Okay, the tabernacle is symbolic of human creativity and creative activity, and divine creativity and creative activity. Okay, and the things you're supposed to stop doing are the symbols of that kind of work, value added. Things that bring some new life into the world. That's why, by the way, if you do something that looks like a melacha, but it's really just a destructive act, okay, you can't, you know, tear a piece of aluminum foil because that creates a usable piece of aluminum foil. But if you've got a nervous tick and you like tearing up napkins, that's not a problem. Because that's simply absent-minded, bland, destructive activity. So melacha has to be creative, has to contribute something to the world in order to be a violation. Good. So we're stopping our creative activity. We're affirming the self. How do you do that? Okay, what is the thing you are supposed to do on Shabbat in order to make this happen? Well, part of it, of course, is resting, and part of it is spending time with your family, and part of it is having a good meal, and part of it is going to shul and davening. But the real deal, according to the rabbis, the thing that Shabbat was made for is Torah study. Now, the rabbis had a concept of Torah study. I'm gonna wrap up on Shabbat quickly, but we have to cover this because it's crucial. The rabbis had a concept of Torah study. Let me tell you what it didn't look like. Okay, it didn't look like people pulling out the Vilna Shas and opening it up and studying all the commentaries, because all of those texts were written later than when the rabbis said that the Shabbat was for Torah study. Okay, they probably didn't really have written books at all. What they actually had was a very large number of wise people who had learned a tremendous number of wise sayings. And they would repeat them to try to make sure they never forgot them, and they would teach them to their students, and they would talk about them, and they would discuss them. That's what Torah study looked like back then. And somewhere there might have been scrolls that were kept very, very carefully, but you didn't have, there weren't universal printed texts, and certainly not e-books. But you also had one big difference in Torah study between what it was then and what it is now, which is that you had a much more ambiguous, it wasn't that they didn't have a distinction between Kodesh and Chol, between philosophy, let's say, and wisdom. is that the lines were very, very ambiguous, what constituted learning that was somehow outside of Torah. I want to give you an example. I want to quote a midrash about Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai was the head, you know that he was really important because there were rabbis, and then there's Rabban. If someone's got a name Rabban, okay, that means he was the head of the Sanhedrin. He was really, really, really important. He was like the chief Jew. And Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai was the chief Jew at the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. He was the one who led the retooling of Judaism after the destruction of the Temple into something that could survive outside of a sovereign Jewish state. And according to the Talmud, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai was a very, very, very wise man. And his wisdom, and they have a list of all the things he knew. Okay, and here's what he knew. His wisdom included, quote, of course, it included Mishnah and the Tanakh, and, you know, I guess Breitot or whatever, not, you know, I mean, God, this is before the Mishnah even. So they didn't have Breitot. They just had all these statements by smart rabbis. So he knew all the statements of the smart rabbis, and he knew the Tanakh. And that was more or less what today we would call Limudei Kodesh. But he knew more than that. He knew, quote, constellations and calculations, the sayings of launderers and the sayings of fox keepers, the conversation of demons and the conversation of palm trees, the conversation of the ministering angels, the great things and the little things. Okay, wisdom was seen as a very broad thing. Torah was seen as a very broad thing. It was embracing the breadth of human wisdom. That's why when, you know, these famous crazy stories when Rava is going to the bathroom and his student comes and tries to follow him in, he says, "What are you doing here?" And he says, "But this too is Torah and I must learn it." Okay, and that night when he's going to bed with his wife and he discovers the same student hiding under the bed and he says, "What are you doing here?" And he says, "But this is Torah and I must learn it." Okay, it's the comprehensive wisdom of how to live our lives. That's what they mean when they said that Shabbat is for Torah study. It includes what we today call Torah study, but it's also much, much wider. And perhaps, and I'm just throwing this out, perhaps it also includes anything that we can do to increase our wisdom about how to live, whether it means spending time with wise people or studying literature and poetry or just going for a productive walk in the woods to meditate a little bit. The point is that the affirmation of the self in the Sabbath is the turning point. It's the point at which we deepen ourselves so that we can then become expansive, so that we can then embrace the world, so that we can then redeem, as we saw in the first commandment. Okay, this is really, really crucial because I believe that this perhaps is one of the most fundamental differences between Judaism and Christianity. And classical, original Christianity. They have two different concepts of the self that are completely, completely cannot be reconciled. The classic Christian version of the self, I'm going to start talking in words that are, I'm just going to suddenly sound like a Christian. Watch. The ego and the self are the problem. The only way to bring God's grace into this world is to cancel yourself and to turn yourself into a vessel so that God's grace may come down into this world and bring good into the world. Okay? Christian goodness relies upon the cancellation of the self in order to make room for good to come from elsewhere. In the Hebrew Bible, it's very much the opposite. Very much the opposite. Okay? The self must be invested in, must expand, must be good and become great so that we may expand and embrace others and take care of others under our wing. Now the difference is, there are huge differences, because if you believe in canceling the self, what you end up with is a vision of goodness that's universal. Okay, it's an automatic universalism that disdains concepts like family and community. They might be useful, but they're not really the real good. The real good is to not care about differences between, you know, helping your brother versus helping a total stranger. The greatest Christian act of goodness is to help the total stranger. Okay? In Judaism, and in, I believe in the Tanakh, it's very much the opposite. We must build ourselves. We must take care of our health. We must take care of our financial well-being. We must build ourselves so that we can expand and help others. And this becomes really, really crucial in understanding the concepts of goodness in the Tanakh. Let's run forward through the other, to the next five.
Watch that.
The fifth commandment is about honoring our parents, but I believe that in the Tanakh it's actually not just about honoring our parents, but honoring a very specific thing that our parents give us more than anybody else, and that's a certain kind of wisdom that's different from Greek wisdom, different from ancient wisdom, different from understanding causes and effects and understanding logic and understanding philosophy. The wisdom that the Bible believes in is human wisdom. Okay? It's human wisdom. It's the wisdom of Solomon who knew how to judge. It's the wisdom of knowing how people work and how to bring goodness into the world. And that's something we owe first and foremost to our parents, who teach us the instincts of human relations more than anybody else. 6, 7, 8, and 9 are one verse. Okay, one verse, all said real fast. Lo tirzach, lo tinaf, lo tignov, lo tanel reyacha, id shakev. Thou shalt not. The famous big thou shalt not are negations that affirm. They're an affirmation. 5. Okay. An affirmation of the principles of life, of love. Romantic love is affirmed in the Bible. Of property, which leads to a concept of freedom, and of community. The 10th commandment, I want to read it for the 10th commandment, please. Francis, you on? Coveting. We usually assume, we intuitively assume that the 10th commandment, which is kind of an afterthought, it's kind of at the end of the list, it's kind of unimportant. I believe that it's actually a crescendo, that it's actually, you're getting to some very, very huge, important, overwhelming statement, and that we have to understand the 10th commandment, not just to understand it on its own merits, but to understand the entire path that we have followed up till now. First of all, there's a literary reference in the 10th commandment, right? Where else do we see a list, your neighbor, your ox, all these things? What other commandment do we see that in? In the 4th commandment, Shabbat. So there's an echo of Shabbat. There's also an echo back to the 1st commandment because, like the 1st commandment, it's not exactly a concrete action that is being addressed. It's a philosophy. It's a state of mind. It's an attitude. So in a sense, there's a kind of bookends going on between the first, you know, there's a dialogue between the first and the 10th commandment, and there's an echoing of the 4th commandment. What is coveting all about? What's wrong with coveting? What does it reflect?
It leads to a contradiction
of the other one. If you covet, then you might steal, you might
murder. Okay, but why do you covet?
Because you wish you were someone else. Okay, coveting reflects a profound dissatisfaction with who you are, right? The rabbi said, Ezu ashir, asameach b'chevko. Who is wealthy, he who is happy with his lot. Now, I need to tell you two stories that appear in the Torah, both of which are about the profound consequences of not having that inner satisfaction. We talk about insecurity, right? We talk about insecurity as a psychological problem, as a health issue. The Torah talks about this insecurity as a moral problem, as a moral failing. Okay? There are two hugely important stories in the Torah in which insecurity brings about downfall. One is the sin of the spies. Okay, the Israelites are in the desert we know that they traveled the desert for 30 years. It's funny. Everybody seems to know they traveled the desert for 30 years, I'm here, you know, in some congregations it's more clear than in others. But there are a lot of places where nobody has any idea why. Okay, the sin of the spies was the most heartbreaking, horrific moment in the entire desert odyssey. Right? Moses is about to, you know, we're only a couple of months into the trip. He's about to invade the land of Canaan, the land of Israel, the land of Abraham. And he sends 12 spies on a simple, pure military reconnaissance mission. Go and find out what's there so that we can plan our attack. That's it. And they come back and they say, you know what? It was really scary. These people are big, and they're really, really scary, and they have fortified buildings, and you know, the land's a nice land, but frankly, we were as grasshoppers in their eyes and in our own eyes. And not only did they say, we can't win this war, they then went to the Israelites and told them, guys, this is a bad idea. Moses doesn't know what he's talking about. And so, and they, all the Israelites said, oh my God, we're going to die, we're going to die. Why did you bring us out in the desert to die? And they completely resulted in a complete failure of the spirit. And what's their punishment? They have to wander the desert. God more or less gives up on this generation. He says, you guys aren't ready for freedom, aren't ready for being out there post-slaves and making a whole world. You're not ready. Maybe your children will be, but you're going to wander the desert because you have dehumanized yourselves, and your punishment shall symbolically reflect that. Now, where else have we seen that same punishment? What other story has the same punishment of wandering? Cain, right? Cain and Abel. A completely different crime with the exact same punishment. And believe me, when you see the same punishment for two different crimes, there's a deeper connection. Find out what that connection is. Okay, Cain is a farmer. Abel is a shepherd. They both bring their sacrifices to God. They're brothers. They're really the first brothers ever. And God accepts Abel's sacrifice, doesn't accept Cain's sacrifice for whatever reason. Cain is very, very upset. He's heartbroken. His face falls. And God says to him what is probably the most important verse in the entire Torah. I bet you never knew what the most important verse in the entire Torah is. Okay, I'm about to tell you, at least for our purposes. He says, why are you angry and why are you crestfallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not, sin crouches at the door, and to you will its desire be, but you may rule over it. Okay, those of you familiar with East of Eden by Steinbeck know that this became the central pivot around which the entire story turns. If you do well, you'll be accepted. And if you don't, there are two possible paths, and you need to be very aware of this. One is your spirit collapses. You lower your image of yourself. You say, if I'm garbage, you know what? I'm going to treat everybody else as garbage. And you fall down a path into sin. Sin crouches at the door. The other possibility is to overcome that. You may rule over it. The very next thing Cain does is to murder his brother. He chooses the first path. And his punishment is exactly the same punishment as that of the Israelites. He has allowed his spirit to collapse. He dehumanizes himself. He decides that he doesn't have to be good. And he goes to the path of murder. And God says, because you have dehumanized yourself, you will wander. Now, what this does is to take the concept of, you know, we call security, turns it into a mitzvah. And it takes the entire Ten Commandments and puts it in a certain light in which this really is the sin behind other sins. It's a meta sin. Not medicine. Meta sin. And it creates a worldview that is perhaps the most powerful, unique statement about how to live our lives that the entire ancient world ever produced. And it becomes a lot more clear why these ten, and why these are the focus of the whole Torah and of the whole wandering through the desert. Now, I just want to finish with one little thing. Of course, I'm often asked about the question of authorship. Who wrote the Ten Commandments? Right? So we have Jewish tradition, and the Torah itself makes it very clear there was a first set of commandments that God wrote on the tablets that Moses carved. And there's a second set that probably Moses wrote with the same words on the okay, but at any rate, it's original, it's mosaic, great. Of course, the scholarly world has its own take on who wrote the Ten Commandments, on an authorship. They have not come up with any compelling conclusions on the question. But Mark Twain had a really good answer to this question, which I'd like to share with you. He said that if the Ten Commandments were not written by Moses, then they were written by another fellow of the same name. Thank you very much.